Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. Into Siberia, George Kennan's Epic Journey Through the Brutal, Frozen Heart of Russia by George J. Wallens. George Kennan lost his faith in the Russian city of Tomsk. A journalist, he came in the summer of 1885 to report on the country's exile system, which every year sent thousands of men, women, and children to the wilds of Siberia, intending that they should work, be forgotten, and die. In Tomsk, he found what one local official called the worst prison in Siberia, where entire families crowded into cages too tight for them to move. The air was noxious, and the hospital was so saturated with disease that a physician there was lobbying to have it burned down. Kennan had come to write a defense of the sprawling network of work camps and prisons. Tomsk broke him. The exile system is worse than I believed it to be, and worse than I have described it, he wrote in a letter to the publisher of Century Magazine. It isn't pleasant, of course, to have to admit that one has written upon a subject without fully understanding it, but even that is better than trying, for the sake of consistency, to maintain a position after one sees that it is utterly untenable. Into Siberia, Gregory Wallens's new biography of Kennan, convincingly portrays him as one of the 19th century's most influential journalists, arguing that Siberia and the exile system, his account of his 1885-86 journey, was what first soured American relations with Russia. Kennan was related to George F. Kennan, the Cold War era diplomat, who would later make his own mark on the Russo-American relationship. Kennan first visited Siberia in 1865. The stated purpose of that expedition was to lay telegraph lines, but Kennan was actually motivated by the same thing that drove so many Victorian explorers: fragile masculinity. As a child, he'd seen a friend's arm crushed by machinery, an experience that scarred him not because of his companion's agony, but because young Kennan had grown faint at the sight of blood. During that first trip, he banished forever the fear of being afraid, which had poisoned so much of the happiness of my boyhood. He endured cold and hunger, rescued lost Americans, got lost, and found himself. It was the stuff of adventure stories. When he came home, he turned it into his first book, Tent Life in Siberia. The book established Kennan as a journalist and an expert on Tsarist Russia at a time when Americans looked fondly on the country, which they considered, Wallens writes, a colorful but mysterious land filled with tragically romantic characters. That's the place Kennan thought he was headed when he persuaded Century Magazine to fund his 1885 trip, an eccentric place, certainly, but basically benign. He'd spent years defending the exile system, calling it a more humane punishment because it allowed families to remain together. The misery described in books like Dostoevsky's The House of the Dead was, Kennan believed, the relic of a bygone era. When he arrived in St. Petersburg, along with the illustrator George Frost, he found that neither the country nor the people looked as if they were oppressed by an iron-handed despotism. Tomsk changed his mind, but it was far from the worst that he'd see. Kennan and Frost marched alongside chained men being driven thousands of miles across the wilderness. They crawled through silver mines where convicts toiled in near darkness, in tunnels dug during the reign of Catherine the Great, where the supports were so rotten that they were no longer recognizably wood. They met educated exiles barred from any intellectual activity, some of whom were driven mad by boredom. They saw the full scope of a system that was chaotic, corrupt, and exquisitely cruel. Kennan responded to this ugliness by opening his heart. In the exiles, he found more people whom I could love, more people who would be dear friends, more people whose souls are akin to mine than I had met in all the previous 10 years of my life. He told their stories in a mammoth book and on a years-long lecture tour, during which as many as a million people watched him don the rags and chains of the marching exiles and sing their haunting begging song. It was a performance that moved many to tears, including Mark Twain, who, according to some reports, responded, "If dynamite is the only remedy for such conditions, then thank God for dynamite." In Wallace's bracing narrative, Kennan emerges as a cheerful, deeply decent companion, an uncompromising observer whose greatest strength was his ability to change his mind. He's a welcome change from the callous imperialists who people most Victorian travelogues, and his humanity allows Into Siberia to delve into horror without succumbing to despair. This review was written by W.M. Akers, who is a novelist, editor of the newsletter Strange Times, co-host of the film podcast I'll Watch Anything, and creator of the game Deadball, Baseball with Dice. Falling Rocket, James Whistler, John Ruskin, and The Battle for Modern Art by Paul Thomas Murphy. I have seen and heard much of Cockney impudence before now, but never expected to hear a coxcomb ask 200 guineas for flinging a pot of paint in the public's face. These words, by John Ruskin, Victorian England's preeminent critic, were written in 1877 about Nocturne in Black and Gold, The Falling Rocket, a painting by James Abbott McNeill Whistler, the most flamboyant artist of that era. And they resulted in the most notorious trial in the history of art when Whistler decided to take the shocking step of suing the writer for his review, as much for the publicity as for the 1,000 guineas in damages. Both artist and critic were already very famous. Whistler, the American-born dandy, esthete, and provocateur, made a compelling contrast to Ruskin, who for decades had served as moralistic defender of a spiritual gravitas rooted in the Middle Ages. The painting that so inspired Ruskin's ire supposedly conjured a fireworks display, though, as the darkest and moodiest of Whistler's nocturnes, it was as close to pure abstraction as art had yet ventured. Whistler had first exhibited the shocking oil at London's Grosvenor Gallery. Ruskin's scathing review initially appeared in the July 1877 edition of his newsletter, Fors Clavigera. The art world was agog. Whistler saw this as a chance to gain some much-needed funds and to publicly state his views on art in opposition to the most celebrated cultural theorist of the time. But Ruskin himself never took the dock, incapacitated as he was by a series of breakdowns, and he instead had Edward Burne-Jones, the pre-Raphaelite painter, testify on his behalf. The November 1878 trial lasted only 2 days, but it was an immediate cause célèbre in the international press. Whistler was in magnificent form. His flow of witty remarks greeted with applause. On revealing that his painting had taken just 2 days to complete, Whistler was asked if it was not presumptuous to price it at 200 guineas. "No," Whistler responded, "it was for the knowledge gained through a lifetime." His braggadocio paid off barely. In the end, though Whistler technically won the case, the jury awarded him a mere farthing, a comically tiny amount that made clear they were equally sympathetic to Ruskin. Whistler, however, proudly played it as a total victory and wore the farthing on a watch chain, often restaging his courtroom triumph for friends. And he certainly went on to ever-increasing fame and success, the avant-garde minimalism of his work eventually finding its time. Ruskin felt insulted and legally fettered by the verdict. Even a public subscription to cover his legal costs did not allay the deeper gloom that already owned him. Often mistakenly read as a clear victory for new art over reactionary criticism, this trial was also a notable precursor to many a modern battle, both in court and in the mass media. The trial set a precedent for the attempt to sue critics for negative opinions, helping create the world in which many of us live today. After Whistler v. Ruskin, probably the most contentious such case was when Dan Muldea, inflamed by a review of his book, sued for $10 million in punitive damages, taking the case all the way to the Supreme Court. The publication in question was the New York Times Book Review. Such precedents shall surely temper any criticism of the current volume by Paul Thomas Murphy, entirely enjoyable in its breezy enthusiasm, but possibly not needed at all. The jacket flap may proclaim this is an untold story, but the exemplary bibliography makes clear how much has already been written on this subject, often with either considerably more poetry or academic rigor. But this is an unashamedly approachable good read, as befits an author with several advanced degrees in Victorian studies, with only the slightest whiff of the cut-and-paste potboiler deploying the sort of prose in which a painting is described as a stunner and declaring that Gandhi read Ruskin with earth-shattering consequences. Perhaps the most topical subtext of this book is one of blackness, both political and pictorial. The word black is omnipresent throughout the narrative. For Whistler, it was the universal harmonizer at the core of his practice, a color which he loved in paint. As a subtext, the American Civil War shadows Whistler's story. His brother was a Confederate soldier and spy. He himself knew the family of Robert E. Lee. Infamously, Whistler himself once nicknamed a Haitian the Marquis of Marmalade, slapped an abolitionist who objected to his rhetoric, and served guests creme Uncle Tom. For Ruskin, the color was a state of mind, symbolized in black blight weather. If Whistler seems the more contemporary of the two, not least because of his gift for self-promotional outrage, it is worth remembering that the gloomy Ruskin was the most unexpectedly prescient. It was in 1875 that he warned of some terrible change of climate coming upon the world for its sin like another deluge. This review was written by Adrian Denat, the author of Doomed and Famous. Yours for the Taking by Gabriel Korn. Yours for the Taking follows an ensemble cast in a dystopian near-future world where climate change and capitalism have rendered Earth toxic. The ultra-rich have fled to luxury shuttles in outer space. Back on the planet, an enterprise called the Inside Project is creating sealed habitats on top of cities designed to shield humanity from the climate's dangers. Each Inside is funded and designed by a different corporate sponsor, but there isn't enough room for everyone who seeks refuge. Korn's novel focuses on the Inside built over New York City, bankrolled by Jacqueline Millender, a white cis woman, feminist, multi-billionaire, and cultural icon known for creating Instagrammable women's clubs reminiscent of The Wing, and writing books about her rise to power reminiscent of Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In. But Millender has a secret agenda for her Inside. Only women will be allowed. And the accepted residents won't know this until they've arrived and been locked in. What does Millender mean by women, though? She's unconvinced trans women should be allowed in her women-only Inside. She's also unsure about trans men and non-binary folks, and really anyone who isn't a cis woman. Millender's logic for defining womanhood will leave the reader queasy, but applauding Korn's satire of TERF rhetoric. At its core, this novel is an exploration of the violence of white, trans-exclusionary, radical feminism. A plot recalling Brave New World props up the book's commentary. The characters who gain entry to Millender's Inside discover a steep price for their safety. They are drugged, brainwashed, and coerced into carrying and raising a new generation of children, all in service of yet another of Millender's secret goals. The drama of the novel comes from watching the characters be changed and challenged as they try to survive in Millender's warped dollhouse. The action of the book will keep the reader turning the pages, but it does not compensate for the character's lack of complexity. Millender is an entertaining parody of white feminism, but she crumples into a two-dimensional villain as the book goes on. The characters orbiting her fare even worse. The book also follows Ava, a queer, upper-middle-class, white, cis woman who is accepted to the New York Inside, her ex-girlfriend Orchid, a working-class, white, cis woman who is rejected for residency, Olympia, a black, queer, cis woman and medical doctor pressured into running Millinder's Inside, Shelby, a white trans woman who becomes Millinder's devoted employee, and Brooke and July, Ava's children, young cis girls of Generation A who were born in Inside. If these descriptions seem overly concerned with identity signifiers, that's because the book is deeply concerned with identity. We are meant to see the tension between Millinder's white feminist ideals and the realities of the black, trans, and working-class lives of the people forced to live in her world. But it is hard to get excited about Korn's representative efforts when her characterization of those lives doesn't go deep. The characters of diverse backgrounds are frequently sidelined, ushered offstage by a variety of plot developments, only to return at the 11th hour to facilitate a Rainbow Coalition denouement. These characters feel hemmed in, allowed to speak only when conveniently performing ideological functions. Despite aiming to critique exclusionary feminism, Korn struggles to extend ample page time and complexity to marginalized identities, to offer them true narrative inclusion. Is it possible to dismantle white feminism from the inside, or the inside? At the action-packed end of this book, the characters make big moves, and Korn seems to suggest it is. The ending sets up a sequel, which is in the works. Queer writers and writers of color have long been publishing science fiction that radically reimagines the world and challenges our ideas for living in it. Think of Octavia Butler, Rika Aoki, Samuel Delaney, Rivers Solomon, and N.K. Jemisin. Yours for the Taking is an effective scale model of the white feminism we already know, and there's value in this, even if Korn's world-building isn't as ambitiously radical as that of her literary antecedents. Still, despite its hopeful ending, this novel's shortcomings remind the reader that we're not red-pilling our way out of the matrix of exclusionary feminisms anytime soon. This review was written by C.J. Hauser, who is a writer and a professor of creative writing at Colgate University. They are the author of The Crane Wife, a memoir in essays, and the novel Family of Origin. Welcome Home, Stranger, by Kate Christensen. In the first sentence of Kate Christensen's unflinching eighth novel, Welcome Home, Stranger, the reader learns that Rachel Calloway's mother has died, and she does what most people do when a parent passes away. You get on a plane and go home. Rachel, an award-winning climate change journalist, barely manages to collect herself for a flight bound for Portland, Maine. My jeans are flecked with lint. My eyes are gritty. My teeth scuzzy. My hair a cloud of chaos, she says. I look and feel exactly like what I am. A middle-aged, childless, recently orphaned, menopausal, workaholic journalist. As it turns out, Rachel hasn't returned home in almost a decade after a falling out with her negligent, alcoholic mother. Christensen's use of present tense brings an immediacy and urgency to her storytelling, with the reader riding shotgun as Rachel tumbles headlong into the chaos of her life, past and present. In contrast, her privileged younger sister lives a life of shiny domestic perfection, or so it seems. Celeste, who nursed their mother through her illness, ferries her teenage twins around in a Mercedes SUV while her wealthy husband, a wannabe playwright, sips one glass of wine after another. "This is my family. These are my people," Rachel tells us. "It's not easy to come back here, not easy to find my place again. Like a book I abandoned midway through and lost the thread of." Given the spotlight on midlife, one might describe Welcome Home, Stranger as a menopausal novel, comparable to Dana Spiata's Wayward, which tells the story of Samantha Raymond, a 53-year-old woman looking for meaning amid the turmoil following the 2016 election. Indeed, our shelves could use more women like Rachel and Sam as a counterpoint to men in midlife who have dominated fiction for decades. Richard Ford's Frank Bascom, John Updike's Rabbit Angstrom, Saul Bellow's Moses Herzog, among others. It's exhilarating to read an uninhibited female character who is rife with contradictions, passive and full of agency, thoughtful and self-centered, calculated and impulsive. It's a weird age, isn't it? Rachel asks her high school nemesis. I can feel myself becoming invisible. It's a diminishment and a superpower at the same time. Christensen also does a skillful job of animating difficult family relationships while avoiding a conventional arc of forgiveness. When Rachel returns to the land of her childhood, the compass of her former self often doesn't lead her in the right direction. Her old boyfriend has married her sister's best friend, and let's just say some passionate antics ensue. Later, Rachel recruits a homeless veteran to help renovate the townhouse she's inherited from her mother. Once again, complications arise. All the while, Rachel is attempting to make sense of the strained relationship she had with her mother. As a middle-aged, childless woman who lost both parents not too long ago, I appreciate Christensen's efforts to explore this gray territory of intimacy and estrangement. It's not an easy story to tell. Nevertheless, Welcome Home, Stranger doesn't always deliver. Driven by Rachel's over-analytical first-person voice, the narrative, as well as the dialogue, is frequently freighted with exposition, which in turn sometimes flattens the reckless spirit of the novel. A subplot related to the narrator's own patterns of drinking and abstinence doesn't quite track, and a pile-up of convenient plot turns gave me a bit of whiplash. Some of these choices underscore reality. When a neglectful parent dies, a seamless, well-choreographed narrative rarely follows. Christensen doesn't shy away from this ugliness and all that goes with it. At the same time, she attempts to seek some measure of peace and resolution for Rachel, who eventually loses everything before she begins to see the present and the past with more clarity. In one of the closing scenes, our protagonist wanders into the woods of the family's camp in northern rural Maine. There's the low murmur of moving water, sleepy bedtime discussions among the birds, a rustling as nocturnal animals emerge, the warm, low-lying daytime air lifting with a great collective sough into the soothing sky, writes Christensen. I feel a chill on the back of my neck. In the end, it is surprising to see where Rachel meets herself. Despite relentless challenges, she manages to find her own footing, so to speak, on her home turf, and discovers a new place for herself at the same time. This review was written by S. Kirk Walsh, who is the author of The Elephant of Belfast. The Second Stranger by Martin Griffin. A nasty February storm has cut off phone service at the remote McKinnon Hotel in the Scottish Highlands, where Remy York is working at the front desk. Suddenly, an injured man comes through the door, identifying himself as Police Constable Don Gaines, and saying that he's been in a car accident, and that the dangerously manipulative inmate he was transporting from the local prison has escaped. The policeman is securing the premises when another injured man arrives, the title character in Martin Griffin's The Second Stranger. In a dismaying turn of events, this new visitor also claims that he is PC Gaines, and that the first man is the escaped prisoner, Troy Foley. This is what he does, one of the men says of Troy. He plays roles, he manipulates, and confuses. Both men seem equally plausible and equally implausible. Further complicating matters, one of the two remaining hotel guests seems to be surreptitiously recording his conversations with Remy, while the other has gone missing. Remy's own memories about a criminal brother who was killed in prison contribute to a sense that she, too, is keeping secrets from the reader. Are any of them telling the truth, and will any of them get out alive? Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.